So Hugo lunged into the air and hung there. All five lions on the floor of Baskerville Hall began to emit a faint light. Streaks of purple fire shot from Sir Hugo towards Holmes. Much to my wonderment, Warlock seemed pleased by this. The first fireball he simply sidestepped. The second two he blocked by raising chunks of rubble into their paths. And the fourth...
Azazel, stop it!
Ow!
The fireball winked out just a few feet from Holmes. I made good use of the time, dodging across the room to Eliza Barrymore, who, I must say, was cooler under fire than many of my army comrades had been at my wand. I told her the same thing I told John.
You have no worry of me. I will stay my ground.
They're in place.
Good. Get my knapsack. Use the items in it to block another line.
That required more boldness than I cared for. The knapsack lay at Holmes's very feet, and he was the subject of quite a bit of negative attention. A number of translucent arms rose from the ground to clutch at Holmes's feet. I'm fairly certain it was an accident, but one of them grabbed the knapsack as it groped blindly about. I had to kick and kick at it, but it finally let go. Holmes was doing his best to keep Sir Hugo engaged in conversation rather than battle.
A pity you weren't Moriarty's slave longer. He could have taught you some art. Look at this. So much power. No subtlety. No restraint.
I scooped up the knapsack and ran. When I reached inside to draw out the objects, my hand came down on a slippery, wet, flesh-like gob. I almost yelped, but mastered my disgust and drew out a mildew-covered leather feed bag. The second item was not as bad. An old wooden spindle from some long-forgotten spinning wheel. That was all.
A proposal, Sir Hugo. Let us take turns hitting each other with the softest killing spell we know until one of us is dead. I wish you to know how little it takes to destroy you. You may go first, muster your wit, hit me with your softest shot.
Sir Hugo did take a turn, but not the one Holmes had asked for. He smiled back and raised his hands.
Mulchimer!
Even I could feel the magic gathering. The white lines on the floor pulsed with energy. For an instant, fire burst from Holmes's mouth and eyes, just as it had from Selden's the night before. I thought all was lost.
I think not.
Holmes raised his hand skyward. All the candles in the hall's many dusty candelabras burst into flame at once.
All force, no art.
All around me, I could feel the suffusion of magic coming to life. On the far side of the room, the top hat I had placed began to shake and bump.
Oh, look. Look what I have found.
The jeweled comb slid an inch further away from me. I plopped the disgusting leather feed bag down onto the last two-way line and began my headlong run for the other side of the room. I no longer cared for subtlety, hoping my enemy was too embattled to notice. Sir Henry was, but Beryl wasn't.
What is that one up to?
Shut up! Holmes! Grab Holmes!
Please don't.
But Beryl spread her wings and flew straight at him. I saw her claws cut his arm and shoulder as she dragged him backwards. When he hit the table, Sir Hugo smiled.
Tablo siavice in monstro!
The dining table sprouted 2 6-foot splinters right through Holmes's legs. I don't know if it was a legitimate accident or if Sir Hugo really had so little care for Beryl, but one of the splinters pierced her through her abdomen, just above the left hip. For an instant, she and Holmes were pegged together by the great table of Baskerville Hall. But only for an instant. No sooner had the splinters pierced Holmes than his eyes lit up their fiercest green and the great table liquefied and splashed down onto the floor. It was amongst the strangest things I had ever seen. It is not that it turned to water, oil, or any known liquid. It was still wood. It flowed like water. It splashed as I ran through it. Yet, even in its strange new state, it kept its grain. Oh, and it gave me a devil of a time finding the other side of the third ley line. Throwing myself to the floor in what I judged to be basically the right area, I feverishly swiped wood sauce this way and that, until I caught a glimpse of the lighter marble. I dropped the spindle into place.
Done. What now?
In response, my mind flooded with agony and I fell grasping at my legs. I slapped at them, trying to understand what had injured me, but there was nothing, only the projection of what Holmes was feeling. It came through with the rest of his thoughts. It was hard to tell which was more terrible.
Oh, nothing, Walton. That was all I found.
The pain subsided, yet the horror of that statement remained. We had not addressed the two short lines at all, and I hadn't seen any effect from my work on the other three. If only we'd had time to find more allies, or time to form a better plan, but no, our time was up. Sir Hugo hovered farther into the room.
Ah, it feels so good to be home. Do you know how hard it was, restraining myself at all Sir Charles's damned parties, with the lines just right here?
As he neared, the glow from the ley lines increased.
Morag! Morag! Where are ye? Run! The horses! They might! Legs! Ah, my legs! Run, Morag! Run!
Warlock tried to stand, but instead crumpled to the ground. Having just felt what I presumed to be his pain, I understood that the fight was not going our way. Until a moment before, I had kept up hope, but now it seemed to have been only a fool's dream. Was there nothing I could do? One solution presented. There, in the rubble to my right, I could see the gleam of my trusted Webley. When in doubt, I dove upon it, yanked back the hammer, aimed, and shot Sir Hugo square in the chest.
Watson, don't be ridiculous.
It's not. It has two beneficial effects. First, it makes me feel better. Second, victory may be yours. You may end the race of man. My fifth shot landed low, just above the hip. But you won't be keeping that jacket. My last bullet tore through his shoulder. I was done. Sir Hugo did not appear best pleased by my behavior.
Let's check!
I felt all my bones begin pulling out through my skin. I can hardly describe my agony as my skeleton began to bend and shift. To my lasting joy, Holmes saved me.
No!
He flung both his arms upwards. As he did, the torturous feeling in my bones rocketed up out of me and into the chandelier. Candles rained down around me into the wood water. I expected they would extinguish, but the few that landed on their sides set pools of the strange wood alight. I could feel the ley lines heave and shift. Holmes had used magic to save me, but to use much more might doom us all. The Hound of the Baskervilles must be coming, I realized. To whose benefit, I could not say. As I drew myself to my knees, Sir Hugo again turned his rage on me.
Mayuma Luma Pluvo!
He summoned a dark ray of unlight which streaked from his fingers towards my heart. Holmes reached out his hand as if to grab it, and the ray suddenly bent, striking one of the stones of the fireplace. The unlucky stone burst into two dozen live bats, which flew about for a few seconds before expiring and plummeting to the floor. Holmes made it to his feet, quite the achievement considering the state of his legs. He turned to face Sir Hugo. A wiser man might have looked behind first. Beryl took him utterly by surprise, slamming into his back. Though she looked to be in poor shape, pale from blood loss, she nevertheless spread her wings and dragged Holmes up into the air. I think she meant to haul him up into the high rafters and drop him, but I will never know for sure. Holmes interrupted her plan with one of the least gentlemanly things I have ever seen. He elbowed her right in her abdominal wound. The two of them tumbled out of the air. Holmes took the brunt of the crash landing. A stirring in the rubble beside me indicated that Sir Henry was awake. I scuttled over to him.
Are you injured?
I ain't at my best, but I guess I've been worse. What's going on, Watson?
You should have stayed unconscious, Sir Henry. You seem to have woken up just in time for the end of this fight, and I'm afraid you won't like it.
We are fighting Sir Hugo?
Yes, well spotted.
And losing?
I'm afraid we are. We must turn the tide quickly, or all is lost. Holmes is faltering.
Damn. Can we help? Have you spotted any weaknesses?
There is one thing. Unlike Holmes, Sir Hugo speaks whenever he casts a spell. If we could stop his voice, we may gain a great advantage.
Well, he's had his throat torn out, ain't he?
What are you proposing? That we should bum-rush the hovering hell wizard? I wish I had a better idea. I don't suppose you're armed.
I am.
From the rubble beside him, he produced the hound's head walking stick and brandished it.
What? No, why does everybody assume? That is not a weapon. Have you ever gone to a museum and seen a painting of armored knights laying about each other with walking sticks? Honestly!
It's the best we got, Watson.
Oh, very well. I'll try to get his legs and bring him down a bit. You get his throat.
Our plan was delayed somewhat by a shift in the fight. John Barrymore pointed out through the shattered entryway. The Hound of the Baskervilles had come to join the fray. Or anyway, he attempted to. Though I'm sure he was trying with all his might. Foofy's charge was somewhat leisurely. Like many older dogs with bad hips, his front half stayed focused on his target, but his back half kept drifting off to one side. He cleared the entry rubble with a feeble leap, then trundled into the great hall. Poor fellow. Dry ground was enough of a challenge for him, but when he made it into the puddle of liquefied table, he was quite overmatched. His back legs slipped and gave out. He tumbled sidelong into the open slop, his haunches passing his head as he slid in a slow semicircle and skidded to a halt. He made some show of trying to move again, dragging himself forward a few feet, but then gave a grand, tired snort, let his head collapse down to his forepaws, utterly bested.
Oh, well done. Mankind's terror given shape. Thanks for all your help.
You think he was here to help us?
I'm not sure. The point seems somewhat academic now.
Sir Hugo drifted closer to Holmes.
Furthermore, Senos, Captilo, Malamico!
Ghostly black chains materialized from the corners of the room and snaked about Holmes's limbs, pulling each of his damaged appendages in a different direction. Holmes' green eyes blazed. One by one, the chains burst into smoke, but were replaced by Sir Hugo as quickly as Holmes could dispel them. Attempting to regain the offensive, Holmes levitated several chunks of rubble and flung them at Sir Hugo. He drew ever closer to the writhing figure of Holmes. In the entire year I'd spent in the company of Warlock Holmes, I do not think all the magical expenditures I think I'd seen him make could match the amount of power he used that one night in Baskerville Hall. Sir Hugo used even more. At that moment, it seemed they crossed a threshold. Anyone who'd ever broken a bone knows you can feel it bending for a moment, strained but not bested, until at last it moves beyond tolerance and gives with a snap. All five ley lines snapped and the floor heaved. All the lights in the room, the blaze in the great hearth, the candles, the burning pools of liquid wood, winked out. The lines went dull. For the tiniest moment, all was dark. Moonlight through the broken wall and Foofy's feeble smolder were the only illumination. In the darkness, the room filled with phantom voices. From the direction of the spindle I'd placed...
Samuel? Samuel, where are you?
There came an answer from the other side of the line, near the moldy feed bag. It was counterpointed by the strident, non-ghostly voice of Eliza Barrymore.
John Eustace Barrymore, don't you run! You stay right where you are!
Husband, why?
The voice came from under the gold and pearl comb.
Why did you push me?
From behind me, another ghost spoke.
Oh, I say, is that my hat?
Then, with redoubled force, the five lines of white marble relit with a bright white glow. True, much of this was hidden by wood juice, but enough of the line showed through that the whole room was lit in phantom splendor. From the lines, thick, luminescent white smoke began to emerge, even filtering lazily up through the liquid table. Beside me, a portly man in his mid-50s, made all of light and smoke, came striding up to the top hat I had dropped.
Glad to have that thing back. Always wanted to be buried in this one, you know. Not the ridiculous thing they stuck on me. Good God, did they think me still a schoolboy?
Sir Charles?
The phantom reached up, removed the spectral straw boater it wore, and replaced it with the top hat.
By Jove! What have you done to my house?
Directly across from him, a lady's hand reached out from the floor to grasp the comb. An instant later, a matronly woman stood tucking it into her hair.
Look! I had it from Hugo the day we wed, before things turned so sour, before he killed me.
Lies! She lies!
Sir Hugo pointed at the ghost of his murdered wife.
She fell!
Falling! Falling! You killed me!
I say, the bastard killed me as well. But I'm not so easy to frighten now, am I, Stapleton?
A phantom farmer was pulling himself up now, taking up the moldering feed bag I had left for him. Across the room, his spectral wife was picking up her spindle. Our battle was momentarily forgotten. All of us mortals, mages, and the demon too, were staring at the ghosts. With a start, I realized this was just the chance I needed. I grasped Sir Henry's sleeve.
Quick! Sir Hugo is distracted!
Sir Henry gave a resolute nod.
One banana, two banana, three banana, go!
We were up out of the rubble and at him in a flash. I suppose it's lucky he was engaged in an argument with his dead wife, or he may well have zapped us to ash before we got near him. He was hovering 5 feet or so above the floor. Thus, with a fairly easy leap, I got my arms about his knees and pulled him down. I reached up to his jacket and yanked downwards, exposing a hideous patch of sewn-on skin, which covered his old throat wound. Brave Sir Henry came in right behind me. He planted both feet wide and gave, well, I suppose the best way to say it was, he gave us all a hideous parody of the Scottish sport of golf. With a grand two-handed sweep, he swung the silver hound's head cane up into Sir Hugo's neck. Sir Hugo gurgled with rage and clutched at his throat. Well, where his throat wasn't. He gave me a kick that sent me tumbling to the ground. I landed staring at a pair of tasteful black evening slippers. Between the prehensile tail brushed gently at the floor. I looked ruefully upwards, sure I would see Beryl's claws lancing towards my eyes. Luckily, the 17th century farm girl, turned succubus, had other things on her mind. She stepped away from me towards the ghostly farmer's wife.
Mama, is it you? Samuel, where are you? They're so close! I can hear the hooves!
As I found myself with a moment's respite, I sought Holmes, looking for direction. He sat motionless upon the floor, frozen with horror, staring at Sir Henry's walking stick. Or as I suddenly realized, Moriarty's walking stick, the one he used to beat Holmes as a child. If it had been left here on that fateful Michaelmas, would it not have been passed from generation to generation with all the other Baskerville heirlooms?
Holmes! Focus!
Yes. Quite right, Walton. Quite right.
He drew both hands together and thrust them upwards. As he did, the liquid wood of the great oak table drew itself together under Sir Hugo and splashed upwards. The instant it caught him, it re-solidified, frozen into a tree. A sort of barkless tree with an evil, throatless sorcerer trapped in it. You know the kind I mean.
Help me to my feet, Walton.
I put my arm beneath his less bloody shoulder and helped him stand. Even with his weight on me, he barely could.
Well done, Walton. You too, Sir Henry. I think your little attack has bought us some precious time. We must hurry, though. There are other ways to do magic apart from speech, and I do not think Sir Hugo will take long in discovering one.
What must we do?
Beryl. I need Beryl.
Sir Henry came to help, and the two of us turned home towards Beryl, who still stood talking to the Phantom Woman.
Mama, why won't you answer me?
She can't. That's not a whole person you're talking to. Not even a whole ghost. After so long, there was very little left of your parents. Just the horror of their final moments.
What happened to them?
You know, I've been dreading that question because there is no delicate way to answer it. They were eaten by horses.
Beryl turned around, spread her wings and claws as if she meant to kill us all. I suppose I could hardly blame her.
Please, Beryl Arnagak, please, listen to me. It is all down to you. I have done what I can, but it is not enough. You will choose the victor tonight, not I or any other. Hear me, spirits! Each of you met your end because of the wickedness of this man, Sir Hugo Baskerville. Do you feel the energy coming to this place? Do you feel it flowing through the lines? That is all that sustains him, all that keeps your murderer alive. If we all push together, we can stop it. Stop the flow and bring justice to the wicked.
But Holmes, there are still two lines unblocked.
One, Walton.
Holmes pointed at Fufi. The tired old beast had collapsed across one of the open lines. It must have been his goal all along.
Only one line left to block, and Beryl Arnagak, it is yours. You are the only one left who can.
I'm not a fool. That would kill me.
I know.
Then why do you think I would help you?
Because if you do not block that line, Sir Hugo will win. He will live here for a time. But look at him. Look at his wounds. Each day it will take more and more energy to sustain him until, at last, he breaks the bounds and demons overrun this world. They'll kill everyone.
Not me! I'm not sure how it escaped your notice, Warlock. But I am a demon.
No, you're not.
She stared at Holmes, incredulous.
I know what happened to you, Beryl Arnagak. I know what he made you, but that's not who you are. This is your home. This world sustained you and everyone you loved. It still does. I know you fancy Sir Henry.
Wait, she does? Do you?
I am a demon!
You're really not.
I lured Sir Charles to his death.
This charge was answered not by Holmes, but by the ghost of Sir Charles himself.
Oh, never mind about all that. It was Sir Hugo's fault, wasn't it? I should have known you wouldn't really want an old codger like me, but, well, I was flattered to be asked.
Beryl blinked, wonder struck at his readiness to forgive her.
What about Sir Henry? I lured him. I made him want me. Watson, too. I turned them against one another. I have done...
I know. The demon Beryl has done wicked things. But Beryl Arnagak? She never would have, not if she'd had any choice in the matter. And now you do. Walk away from Sir Hugo and what he has made you. Come back to the world you love and that loves you. Die as Beryl Arnagak. It's all I can offer.
Well, that offer is just as terrible as your rescue was.
Then you should decline it.
Holmes gave a sad smile. The look of a man at the end of a long game with only one card left to turn. A man who knows the final card will bring him victory, but also long regret.
But what will happen to Sir Henry if you do?
Beryl's eyes turned to Sir Henry. He stared back at her. It was easy to see the yearning they shared. Despite my jealousy, I had to admit those two belonged to one another. Yet, what did it matter? Whatever the strength of it, What is one human feeling against such a gulf of circumstance? This was to be either a world of demons or a world of men, not both.
Come on, Holmes! That ain't fair! You can't ask her to make a choice like that!
It is not fair, but it is fact. I am not giving her this choice, nor do I have any power to take it away. It has fallen to her. Beryl may choose to live as a demon in a world of torment where you must certainly die, Sir Henry. Or she may give you life and restore hope to the race of men, knowing she will never join them. Whether or not she's a demon, she's got the devil's choice to make.
Beryl tore her eyes from Sir Henry and stared at Holmes with murderous rage. Yet in only an instant, they drifted back to Sir Henry and softened.
Hank, I've got to go.
No! There has to be another way!
Can you think of one?
Sir Henry gazed about in helpless desperation. The demon Beryl wiped her eyes, thrust her chin forward, and stepped onto the final line. The ghoulish form of Sir Hugo stirred in his tree.
Beryl, don't...
Ah! Oh no! I don't know how he's doing that, but I don't like it. All you spirits, beasts, and people who are bound to the lines, find the flow. Do you feel it? Push it back! Push! Now!
The light dimmed from the lines.
It's working!
Holmes looked around at the still-lit lines.
Well, it's working a bit. We haven't got all of the magic, but maybe enough? Watson, with Sir Hugo's throat out, how long till he dies?
Well, at the risk of self-congratulation in a moment of tragedy, I did recently have the foresight to inflict 6 fresh bullet wounds on the man. I saw Sir Hugo's eyes flip down towards his torso as he realized with horror that this was true.
Push it back! Push!
Even as the ghost's faces lined with strain, they became less real, more changeable, with old ideas half forgotten. Suddenly, all the specters evaporated into wisps of white smoke. Hugo gave a shake and fell still. Fufi's strength fled him. He sagged where he lay, no breath in that great wide chest. Beryl swayed and fell flat on her face. Holmes did too.
Holmes, what's happened to you?
You know how Sir Hugo was misappropriating the power of the lines to keep himself alive?
Yes.
I might have been guilty of just a bit of that too, so...
I shall endeavor not to burden the reader with the full account of the aftermath of Baskerville Hall. Suffice to say, that joyous moment where we all realized, yay, we won, was rapidly supplanted by the moment where we all realized, ooh, we seem to have several wounded arrayed around the throatless, shot-up corpse of one of the area's most prominent citizens, which is frozen in a magically crafted table tree right next to a dead hellhound, a dying demon girl, and a possibly dying London gentleman who is growing goat horns, all of which would be a lot easier to hide if this building still had a front wall. Dr. Mortimer was sent for with all dispatch. The wounded were shuttled into private rooms. Sir Henry insisted that Beryl be moved next door to his own chamber. Perkins and Gunther were moved to the room on the other side. Holmes had to go in the stable. Though he was unconscious, his twisted right hand continued to grope about with an unsettling level of autonomy, and the bloody black horns began to once again curl forth from his scalp. When the bones of his legs began to shift and elongate into a suspiciously goatish formation, that was the final straw. Was the stable an ideal infirmary? No, but it was vastly preferable to leaving Holmes atop the confluence of 5 ley lines. I set a blanket on 3 bales of hay to form a makeshift bed for him. No sooner had I left than all the horses kicked down their stall doors and ran away. The problem of the tree table, Sir Hugo's body, and Fufi's were all solved by the application of Sir Henry's biggest saw. A laborious drag outside, 2 jugs of paraffin, and 1 judiciously placed match. We'd have to wait for the ashes to cool to hide the bones. When Mortimer arrived, he was too horrified at Beryl's demonic form to touch her, but wasted no time attending to the others. Everyone with so much as a scratch found themselves well stupefied by morphine. Then the work began in earnest. Sir Henry was repatched and sent to bed. Perkins kept his leg, a fact I attribute entirely to Mortimer's skill as a trauma physician. Gunther's wounds proved to be superficial, so as soon as he was bandaged, he came downstairs to be helpful. Well, as helpful as a man can be with his brain pickled by opiates. With Mortimer overseeing our impromptu infirmary, I was free to check on Holmes. There was blood everywhere. I hadn't quite realized the extent of the damage Beryl's claws had done to him. I'm sure he couldn't have survived it if he hadn't enjoyed the patronage of quite so many blood gods. As I cut away his clothing to assess his wounds, he awoke and grasped my arm.
Watson, is that you?
Holmes, you must rest. Yes, it's me.
Is Beryl Alnagag still alive?
She was when I left her. But it cannot last, Holmes. There's nothing I can do.
But try, won't you? You have to try. She's the worst mistake I ever made, Walton. If you can save her, if you can give her back that life I took from her all those years ago, wouldn't it be great?
I leaned back to see his wounds, but he pushed me feebly aside.
I'll be fine. Go help Beryl Alnagag.
Holmes, I can't.
Go try. Here, we'll both go.
What? No. You're not going anywhere, Holmes.
Sure I am. I'll see you later.
I shook my head. Foolish Holmes. I had so much work to do on him, I hardly knew where to start. His shoulder was either broken or out of joint, and he had sustained massive damage to both arms and legs. Yet, I kept looking at his face. I had seen him live through worse, hadn't I? I knew I could not trust my own medical knowledge when it came to Holmes. Then again, could I trust his? A half-delirious promise to be all right was hardly sound medical advice. So, damn it. Hoping it was not a mistake, praying that it would not be a choice I'd regret the rest of my life, I stood up and trudged back to Baskerville Hall. Beryl was alive, but her condition was weird. With Sir Hugo gone and his spell broken, her demon tissues were withering. Her wings drooped. Her tail was lifeless leather. Unfortunately, the rest of her was becoming more real. The 240-year-old mummified pistol wound was returning to a lifelike state. It was beginning to bleed. But there was little I could do except, and oh, how I hope the British Medical Association never reads this, stick a brandy cork in the wound and bandage it up. I had no idea if this would be beneficial. The only certainty was infection. Her abdominal wound took me some hours to patch up, but at least it was within my skill. As I emerged from her room, bleary and exhausted, Sir Henry called out through his open door.
Hey, Watson! How is she?
I joined him.
Unaccountably, she's still alive.
Good. I'm glad she's doing better.
Sir Henry, she isn't.
Nah, she'll be fine.
Fine? She can never be fine, Sir Henry. Even if she lives, do you think she will be unchanged by this? You think she's still going to be delightful Miss Stapleton from down the moor? That person never existed. She is the survivor of hundreds of years of torture and imprisonment. She's barely clinging to life, and who can answer for the state of her sanity? You need to give up on Beryl Stapleton.
I have no excuse for snapping at him like I did. He fixed me with a cool glare and stated in only two words the position that no extremity of fortune, fair or foul, could ever shake him from.
Ain't gonna.
So I didn't either. I ate some bacon and eggs, drank 3 quick cups of tea, and went in to perform my first demonectomy. It went unaccountably well. The first thing that did, when I touched my scalpel to her left wing, the dried tissue broke away, fell to the floor, and crumpled to so much ash. Her right went just as easily, and so did her tail. At first, I had no idea how I might salvage her hands, but simply rubbing them was enough to flake away the scaly talons, to reveal pink fingers underneath. Since her appearance was once again human, I went and found Mortimer, who had been dutifully attending to Holmes, and bullied him into helping me with Beryl's chest wound. We worked for hours, binding and rejoining the damaged tissues of her chest as best we could. It was one of the steepest medical challenges of my life. Mortimer and I staggered out of that room exhausted but wiser. 3 hours later, Beryl woke up and asked for water, and I got a nap. Yet, as I predicted, Beryl's wounds were not the full extent of her problems. Over the next few days, as the others improved and began their journey to normalcy, Beryl's mental state worsened. She spoke of herself as Sir Henry's prisoner, a monster surrounded by humans she'd betrayed, waiting for the constables to come and hang her or burn her alive for her misdeeds. She even mourned Sir Hugo. Yes, he'd been her captor and tormentor, and he'd also been her confidant and her only comrade during her 4 human lifetimes she'd spent trapped in a land of constant torture. The twisted emotional bond it formed, once broken, left her adrift and uncertain. I had no idea how to help her. Sir Henry did. He summoned us all to his bedside and held a meeting. He spoke of financial help for the survivors, and what might be done to repair the gaping hole in his ancestral home. Yet the real business of the day was a toast. He called for champagne and bid us all raise our glasses in salute.
I give you the true hero of the Battle of Baskerville Hall, Beryl Stapleton.
This was met with some coolness. Barrymore was still terrified of her. Molly was deeply religious and fairly sure her priest wouldn't like her saluting anyone with wings and a tail. Sir Henry launched into a vigorous campaign of convincing, cajoling and insisting that he was a lord and lords were always right. Had Beryl spent some time as a temptation demon? Sure. Had she played a part in Sir Charles's death? What of it? The important thing was this, that her first act, once freed from Sir Hugo's tyranny, was to save all humanity. This boon overshadowed and assuaged all her sins. It engendered a debt so profound it could not be repaid by any living man, not by all living men. She'd given us back our world. Sir Henry did not stop his tirade until all present had loudly and publicly admitted the truth of his claim. Due to a prearranged accident which Sir Henry had asked me to see to, his door had been left open. So had Beryl's. She heard every word. I think it helped her. Of course, she still refused to admit that she should not be hung, drawn, and quartered in the public square. This was not a total cure, merely the opening salvo in a battle of wills betwixt the headstrong Canadian baronet and the 262-year-old, 22-year-old who refused to forgive herself and embrace happiness. The war spanned 100 dinner parties and garden gatherings and tested the wit, the fortitude, and patience of everyone involved. By all accounts, the wedding was lovely. Of all the survivors, the last to come around was Holmes. I took to sitting out in the stable beside his hay bed. I always brought my medical kit, even when I knew I wouldn't use it. Often I just sat and watched him. Sometimes I told him things I thought might interest him.
Holmes, Beryl's doing much better.
Holmes opened his eyes and sat halfway up.
By the gods, Watson, it took you long enough.
You're awake.
Of course I am.
Wait, do you mean... You've just been waiting for me to...
Where do you think I've been all this time, Watson? I've been engaged in a somewhat spirited debate with my old friend Sepsis, trying to get him to leave us all alone.
I should have realized it. To have so many patients with wounds so grievous, and none of them had developed an infection? None? It was nearly unaccountable. Holmes really had gone to help Beryl that first night. I was overcome with gratitude. I might have wept if it were not for what he said next.
Watson, can I have some toast?
Toast? Certainly not. Are you mad?
Please, Watson, I really need some.
I'll not be bringing you any toast. By jingle, I'll shoot the man who tries. Toast, indeed.
Well, soup, though?
Water. You may have a few sips of water.
But, Watson...
Maybe broth. Only if the water doesn't kill you. We shall see.
The news that Holmes was awake was met with celebration. Of course, it did make it that much harder to keep him in a stable. Though he might have liked to keep us as pets, Sir Henry arranged for transport for Holmes and me back to London. Before we left, he presented Holmes with the hound's head cane mounted in a tasteful frame to put above our mantle. So I come to end this volume nearly where I began it, with Holmes half dead in his room and me overseeing his recovery, safe in our haven at 221B. There's a symmetry to that, but it is not why I chose to end here. A reader who wishes to credit my wit more than it deserves might point out that this volume starts with Beryl's and ends with Beryl, but that is not the reason either. Indeed, if there is a reader who can spot what this period truly was, then that person might have been wise enough to do what I could not. Stop the impending calamity. That was our respite. When I shot Warlock Holmes, Moriarty ruled his mind and body. When Holmes recovered, he was himself once more. So great was my joy that I never paused to wonder why that was. Did I suppose I'd killed Holmes's greatest nemesis? Did I imagine Holmes had subsumed him once more? I never heard Holmes speak in his voice during that time. I think I simply forgot to pay Moriarty any mind. Gods, it sounds so foolish now. When I think of how blithely I continued on, having my little adventures and thinking everything was well, these were my last days of innocence in a way. What you have just read is nothing more or less than this. It is a chronicle to the period of time between Moriarty's departure and when he came back.
Warlock Holmes No. 2, The Hellhound of the Baskervilles, is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2017, Gabriel Stephen Denning. All rights reserved. Recorded with permission of the author. Production copyright 2017, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and/or duplication is prohibited. With performances by Scott McCormick as Dr. John Watson, Eric Messner as Warlock Holmes, Zeke Alton as Sir Henry Baskerville, Chris Gennebach as Jack Stapleton, Nora Ashrati as Beryl Stapleton, Michael John Casey as Alexander Holder, Patrick Bussink as Vladislav Lestrade, Bradley Smith as Tor Grogson, Lolita Horn as Mrs. Hudson, and Gillian Levine Sisson as Our Parliament of Demons, with Rose Elizabeth Supan, Mort Shelby, Jeff Allen, Kimberly Gilbert, Andy Brownstein, Steve Wanal, Yasmin Toison, David Jordan, Gwen Grassdorf, Jonathan Church, Nanette Savard, Terence Aselford, Ken Jackson, Nick DePinto, Bob Payne, and Richard Rowan as Professor James Moriarty. Additional narration by Colleen Delaney. Directed by Scott McCormick. Adapted for Graphic Audio by Viola Cesario and Scott McCormick. Produced by Rick Rowan, Dwayne Beeman, and Matt Webb. Executive producers, James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Graphic Audio dialogue editing and sound design by Justin Wirtz. Warlock Holmes theme and additional accordion music arranged by David Zitney. Warlock Holmes will return in My Grave Ritual. If you enjoyed the adventures of Warlock Holmes, be sure to listen to the Ghost Finders and Ishmael Jones series, both by Simon R. Green, and Stephen Blackmore's Eric Carter series, all of which are available in glorious graphic audio. Keep listening for a preview of another exciting title in Graphic Audio.
During the summer and fall of 1888, history tells us he killed 5 times, preying on London's poorest and most vulnerable. After 5 of the most brutal murders in the annals of crime, Jack the Ripper simply disappeared. But what if it didn't end there? New York, 1895, and Jack the Ripper's back. And this time, he set his eyes on the city's wealthiest women for his next victims. What does a 14-year-old boy investigating the identity of his lost father have to do with the notorious Saucy Jack?
Katie Miller?
Yes.
Did you ever have a tenant named Jay Cusack?
What would you want with Cusack?
I think he may be my father.
A son to that beast? You do look like him, around the jaw, shape of the skull. But there's something fairer in you. Your mother?
I don't know. I was raised an orphan.
Will even the new secret branch of the Pinkerton Detective Agency be able to stop the killer's latest round of murders?
The police are stymied. If we solve the murder, it would give us just the right opportunity to bring the new Pinkertons out in the open.
Can New York's newest police commissioner clean up a notoriously corrupt force in time to stop the Ripper before he takes his final victim?
Under our noses! The dastardly coward is saying he can do as he pleases whenever and wherever he likes. Can anyone tell us anything yet?
And what about the mysterious and tragic Albert Hawking, the greatest detective of the Gilded Age? Will he leave his self-imposed exile to catch the age's most famous killer?
This isn't a story, boy. It's life. It hasn't changed. You have. Welcome to the abyss. Now you have to decide whether to fall in or not.
Ripper by Stefan Petrucha. They say it takes a thief to catch a thief. What does it take to catch a killer?
You say you want to be a detective. If your father is the killer, you're in a unique position to catch him. Who better to get in the mind of the father than the son?
Now available in glorious graphic audio.
Thanks for listening to this Graphic Audio production. Graphic Audio has over 1,000 titles and 100 series to choose from in high-quality download formats. If you'd like to listen to an entire series, you can now conveniently purchase a download series set from GraphicAudio.net. At GraphicAudio.net, you can also earn loyalty rewards points, redeemable towards future online purchases. You can stream or get full downloads directly to your mobile phone or tablet with our newly updated Graphic Audio Access app, available on all Android and Apple devices. Listen to a movie in your mind, on the go, anytime, anywhere. And be sure to listen to our new free Graphic Audio Story Podcast, GASP, featuring all new serialized episodes of a complete full-length story, along with episodes that feature short stories in our graphic audio format. Once you do, we're confident you'll want to subscribe, give us a 5-star review, and recommend us to your friends and family. You can subscribe to GASP through Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, and RSS feeds. Coming this fall, look for Graphic Audio Streams, our new streaming subscription service. Sign up for our email newsletter for the latest updates and new releases, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter or Instagram. Call 1-800-670-5220 or visit www.graphicaudio.net.